are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sam welcomes their hatred. I'm just playing. It's a pre-recorded debate slash... Actually, I haven't listened to it, but it sounded like very civil discussion.
Just a free exchange of ideas.
Exactly.
But actually, like an actual one.
In the spirit of the Enlightenment.
In the spirit of the Enlightenment Project. Between Glenn Greenwald and Sam Steeder, hopefully the last time we'll cover the Russia story on this show. Though probably not. This was a good conversation, picking some things apart. This was recorded last Friday, so it's still hot off of the presses. And then the team will take over in the fun half, and we will talk about a judge blocking Donald Trump's policies of sending asylum seekers back to Mexico, even as there is an administration purge of ICE calling for even more vicious, vindictive, and vicious policies and family separations. In Brexit news, Theresa May still looking to pivot her way out of this crisis and avert an election.
Kate McKinnon still portraying people like Theresa May somewhat favorably.
Yes, oh, really? Queen. She's trying her best, okay?
Oh, my God. Get the fuck out of here. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Wrong show for swearing. But that is pathetic.
We're sorry. We'll be better.
I mean, Theresa May is, if you look at Windrush, she can go head-to-head with Donald Trump on anything. But anyways, yeah, go do silly Saturday Night Live sketches about her. Why do you guys get me angry even in the show setup? USB drive found at a jail Mar-a-Lago party crasher contained self-executing code.
Shove that baby straight into...
Gunshots and tear gas fired at Sudanese protesters, but the military is playing an ambiguous role, echoing the Egyptian uprising of 8 years ago. The State Department identifies and bans 16 people in the roles of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but MBS is not one of them. Democratic reps are pressing for civilian official counts of civilian casualties in Yemen, as the Trump administration promised a veto on the Sanders-Cano legislation to end U.S. support for the mass murder there. This past weekend marked the first year anniversary of the political imprisonment of Lula da Silva, and tens of thousands marched not only in Brazil but across the globe, and he published an op-ed in Brazil's largest newspaper. We'll have some footage from that and read from his op-ed, all that, and a little bit more on today's Majority Report. How's everybody doing?
Yeah, you know, pretty okay.
Whoa, wait, that's
start of the week.
Strikingly
still
non-peppy for you, Jamie. Are you all right? What's going on?
Well, our insurance ran out, so I haven't been able to pick up my Vyvanse, so I'm a little bit sleepy.
Ooh, that does sound
the pharmacological explanation from Jamie.
Pharmacological explanation from Jamie. Matt?
I'm it's Tuesday. Once Tuesday's over, smooth sailing.
Really? Wednesday's the tough day for me. Brendan, how are you?
I was going to ask Matt if he's going up on a Tuesday. Throw it back to 2015. You remember that song?
No.
No? All right. Well, someone in the chat or online will.
This is Normie Brendan coming through.
Real
world pop culture.
Normie Brendan.
Normie Brendan. I saw in some of the norm votes, Brendan was always the clear leader. I was usually following Brendan, though there was some competition between you and I, Matt. And then Sam and Jamie were rounding out the edges of least
you know,
Normie.
This is like having the loudest whisperer contest, guys. We are
this is
very
like
much
being
in a bubble,
the
far
best
from
skier in Florida, yeah. The best snowboarder in Hawaii. All right, let's deal with this. Meghan McCain's getting spicier by the day. She's straight disrespecting Joy. let's think about this for a second. On The View, you have Whoopi Goldberg, who is an iconic actress and comedian who's been working since the 1980s. Then what is her name? Sunny? Sunny Hostin, who I believe is an attorney, in addition to being a talk show host. Then we have Joy Behar, who's an icon. I've been doing talk shows for, I mean, at least well over a decade. And I think she was also a stand-up comic. I don't know all of Joy's biography. But the point is, some very accomplished people who have gotten there through their merit. Then there's two daughters of prominent Republican politicians. At least Abby Huntsman sort of has the sense. Somebody pointed this out on Twitter. Like, Abby Huntsman at least is kind of like, hey, you know what? Let me at least, like, pretend to be pleasant. Meghan McCain is maybe the most bratty person that I have, like, encountered in any form, real or virtual, who is, like, above 5 years old. It's kind of mind-blowing. And
Joy was here's some
What is Joy? I love Joy. I want to know more about her.
Joy was born to a truck driver father and a seamstress mother.
Oh.
She got her start in show business as a receptionist at Good Morning America and has been building her career for decades since then.
So if Meghan McCain was born to a truck driver and a seamstress, she would be like, I don't know, like being like unhelpful at T-Mobile or something. Which, by the way, there's no problem with at all, but it just, Meghan McCain does not conceive of herself that way. So sure, her vision of herself and reality are shockingly out of step. And this was just, I was shocked that Joy didn't smack her. And I think it's incredible, if you think of all the other like class and racial dynamics of the situation, that Whippy has to step in to calm everybody down. Awkward.
Border states, many friends of mine, this is the number one and only issue. And if we sit here and act like there isn't a crisis.
Basically, Meghan McCain is defending people who are totally freaked out and have paranoid, delusional views about what's going on the border, even though I believe now for like the third year running, there's net negative migration. Go ahead.
Border states, many friends of mine, this is the number one and only issue. And if we sit here and act like there isn't a crisis, that it's just, it's crazy people living in border states that think that there's a crisis at
but
the
like,
winning
like
ticket
I just said,
for Trump.
Like I just
forward.
Said, this guy who's coming in wants to help those countries. That's mm-hmm. the way to solve the problem. Keep them there happy or whatever. Solvent, give them a house, give them food, help them, help their mm-hmm. children.
Give a Nicaraguan
a house.
Stop
the crime rates.
Well, we've had a
I'm
bunch of liberal
about
guests
helping.
Who do not
Hold
want
on.
To send in aid
I
at
listen
all.
To you. Let me just finish.
Yeah, but part of your job is to listen to me.
Okay, so here's Ooh. The deal. Here's what's not going to happen today. We're not going to do this. Everybody gets a conversation piece. Everybody gets to say their piece. And we don't need to comment if we don't like what we're hearing. Just let folks talk.
Jesus Christ. Who is? I had no idea that Michael Ian Black was so worried about immigration. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean, border states aren't all like there's Democrats notoriously doing better in, say, Texas or New Mexico, like in certain parts of Arizona. I don't think Meghan McCain quite has the pulse of border states as well as she
thinks
she does.
There are people in border states who cross the border every day to go to school or work.
My father didn't do that. He didn't cross borders.
Was he actually from even Arizona?
No, he's yeah. I don't remember where he's from. But
how would you feel if I busted that one out next time you interrupt me, Michael? It's your job to listen to me.
That actually would be pretty funny.
Actually, I wonder if I can isolate that as a drop.
I think that could. I think that drop could be used to make fun of every single person in this staff except for Brendan. Could certainly work for any of the rest of us, even you at times, Matt, which is shocking. But of
job
course,
is to listen to me.
That's mostly Sam.
Yeah, part of your job is to listen to me.
That's mostly Sam. That's Sam. Your job is to listen to me, and it's actually true. But what's so interesting? Like the only like thing about this, besides her just being a terrible person, is that all of her defense, like Joy, is actually. Just articulating a super moderate, obvious position, which is like you will have less migration period if you have better conditions in other places, which is just like a truism. But like You notice how like all of her, Meghan McCain's like upset is always about like the emotional expression of a small group of elite people that she knows. Like, well, I know people in border states who feel this way.
They're really scared.
And this is really scary. I mean, sometimes it's literally just her own emotions when like she's freaking out about, you know, one of part of her trust fund getting taxed or something. But like when somebody pointed out they were talking about the racism in the Republican Party. And her, she's like, oh, you really think we're all racist? Like, it's all, like, she is the elite version of that aggrievement politics that Sam's always talking about. Like, in a nutshell. And perfectly positioned, too, because instead of waking up and being like, wow, like, I have totally middling talent and capacity, and I sit on The View every day and make millions of dollars, and I sit next to people who had to work their asses off, and I just got grandfathered into Columbia and or excuse me fathered into Columbia and fathered into show business, and like maybe I should just, I think that is a difference. Maybe it's just because Abby Huntsman is a Mormon and they're more kind of friendly, but there does seem to be like, and I've seen Abby Huntsman call for like cutting Social Security, like she's terrible, but there does seem to be like this tiny glimmer of recognition that like, you know, I've had a pretty nice deal, so let me be like slightly less unpleasant.
Yeah, she probably thanks God every morning, whereas Meghan McCain, I don't know, asks Santa Claus for more things.
Meghan McCain's just like, why didn't Michael Ian Black text me back? What the hell?
Facts don't care about your feelings.
Oh, my God. Majority Report is supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is the mobile app that provides a massive, diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. And the Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. There's a growing body of scientific evidence on the benefits of meditation. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin is using MRI imaging to show how meditation can do everything from decrease stress to potentially even increase empathy and compassion. There is a lot of research on this. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They have guided meditations. I wonder if they have any for joy. They have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, for depression, for when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination, or for when you have something important going on at work, meditation designed for parents. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or on your lunch break or when you've gotten home from work or when you're going to bed. I've primarily used the sleep meditation to help me knock out at night, and that's been incredibly effective and cut down on my laying and looking at the ceiling time, which anybody goes through that, super unpleasant. Different people are trying to accomplish different things with meditation, and Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation or how much past experience they have with meditation. The variety of meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart. Simple Habit just won the 2008 Google Play Award for Best Wellbeing App. It's available on iOS, Android, and web browser. And the Majority Report audience can try it for free for a week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, we've put a link to it in the video description. This is about 55 minutes, folks. Glenn Greenwald and Sam Seder on Russiagate. Russia, Russia, Russia.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Glenn Greenwald. He is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, co-founder of The Intercept. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be back on your program show, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So, all right. So, obviously, big story in the news last, I guess, week or 2 weeks ago was the bringing of the Mueller report, I guess, to the DOJ, the submission of the Mueller report to the DOJ, ostensibly the end of the Mueller investigation, at least under Mueller himself. Some of the prosecutors, my understanding is, have gone off to other jurisdiction and could very well be working on some related investigations. But the Mueller investigation, as it was constructed, is over at this point. And we have seen, as of today, Friday, when we are recording this, only the four-page summary from Barr on the Mueller report. So, all right, I got not a lot of criticism, but some pointed criticism for having any coverage whatsoever of the investigation as it was going on. We, I think we do a daily show. We had maybe three or four interviews that even were tangentially related to the Mueller investigation, or maybe more that were tangentially, but in terms of like the main thrust of the Mueller investigation, maybe three or four over the course of 2 years. And to me, that seemed like it was a legitimate amount of coverage to provide for this. I think you obviously have a critique of the excesses. I think we share in that critique. But let me give you an opportunity to explain, like, why is this such a big deal? I mean, the amount of coverage, because I think we agree that there were certainly elements of the media that got obsessive about this. There were certainly some politicians who were ringing alarm bells. I don't know that we know all that they know or not. There's no way to know, but certainly politicians will leverage what they can. But why is it so important, as it seems to be, in terms of the what you've expressed?
Well, so just let me just address, first of all, the issue of the coverage of your show and the media more broadly. I don't actually have a problem with the media covering the Mueller investigation or any credible allegations of criminality or corruption on the part of the president. I think that's what the media ought to be doing, in fact. My criticism has typically been of media outlets that aired only one side of the story and refused to bring on not just people who believe the Mueller, that investigation would lead to the uncovering of serious criminality, or who believe the Trump-Russia conspiracy, but then kept people who questioned or were skeptical of that theory off their airwaves, so that there was really almost never any debate, which I think is just generally unhealthy. And I don't think that was true of your show. As I understand it, you talked to Matt Taibbi, a few other people who have raised questions over the years about this. So my problem, to the extent that I have a problem with the media coverage, isn't that they covered the story. I think they had to cover the story. The problem was the way in which they covered it, which was often unhinged and irrational, excluding of dissent, which, like I said, I think just generally produces an unhealthy media environment. As far as why the story itself was always so important, in my view, is because if you look at what the core allegations were going back to the 2016 campaign, and then especially once the Steele dossier shaped the public understanding of what the allegations were, they were inherently grave and serious, not just in terms of our domestic policies, but also geopolitically, because of the possibility that they had to seriously influence, for the worse, relations between two nuclear armed powers. That was always those are my two principal concerns, is what is it doing to our domestic politics, and then what is it doing to U.S.-Russian relations. So if you look at the two dominant allegations, the first of which was that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election with the help or participation or collaboration of the Trump campaign. And then secondly, the more serious allegation, which is that once Trump won, he was in some way beholden to the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin, such that Trump was essentially like a blackmail victim, that a foreign country could force him to make decisions that were beneficial to that foreign country and adverse to our own. Those are really serious allegations, right? Like, if either of those were true, those deserve major, major political coverage. I just, from the beginning, believe that neither of them had any basis in evidence. And I think the key event was not the issuance of the four-page Barr letter that people have since fixated on. For me, the key moment was the day before when Mueller closed his investigation without indicting a single American for conspiracy between Trump and Russia over the election, without indicting Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, even though they testified for hours and hours and hours and hours about the Trump Tower meeting, about everything else. On the issue of whether there are other prosecutions, there obviously are other cases, but the whole reason there was a special counsel appointed in the first place was because a decision was made by Rod Rosenstein after Jeff Sessions recused himself that the Justice Department, because it reports to Trump, can't investigate or prosecute Trump officials or Trump family members or people related to the Trump campaign for Trump-Russia conspiracy with regards to the election. So there's, you know, a Southern District investigation into the Stormy Daniels payments, into various forms of Trump's financial dealings. But in terms of the core allegations that have dominated the media for the last 3 years, which is the question of collusion and the question of blackmail, those investigations are done. No, the Justice Department can't investigate those. Once Mueller closed his investigation without any indictments on those core questions, those investigations terminated. But that's why I think it deserved media coverage.
Right. And was it your understanding before the investigation happened that there was and look, I have said ad nauseum on this program that it would be very difficult to quantify to what extent the Russian leak and, or I should say hack, and then leak of the emails influenced the election, and that there are, I think, maybe a dozen other reasons why Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. But was it your understanding before the investigation started that it was established that Russia had interfered in the election? I mean, regardless of
No, I don't think it was established. I think that there were enough allegations being raised that an investigation was warranted. My concern from mid-2016 when these allegations first arose that there was something going on between Trump and Russia, which were first raised publicly by the Clinton campaign when it produced a video saying, what does Russia have on Trump? What's going on between Trump and Russia? Until mid-2017, when Mueller indicted GRU officials, or it might have been later in 2017, was that we were getting a lot of assertions from the U.S. government, from the Department of, from the Director of National Intelligence, from the CIA, that the Russian government was behind the hacking, that Putin himself ordered the hacks. And my position always was that it's certainly very plausible that Russia could have done it, right? Because Russia and the U.S., this is exactly the sort of thing they do to other countries and to one another for decades. Like, it'd be insane to come out and say, oh my God, this is, Russia didn't do this. This is above Vladimir Putin. This, of course, is not above Vladimir Putin or any great power to spy on and interfere in. So my issue simply was, I want to see evidence for it before I believe it, right? I think that's just our journalistic obligation. But I certainly never denied it or even suggested it was implausible. And in fact, one of the frustrations I had going back to January and February of 2017 was that the only things we were learning about all of this were very selected leaks coming from agencies that have a long history of misleading the public, who were protected by anonymity and therefore shielded from accountability. And what was so frustrating was we were getting these piecemeal leaks and all these claims, but no evidence to back it up. And that's why my position had always been, even before Robert Mueller was appointed, was we need some kind of comprehensive, independent investigation that will dig into all of this once and for all, and then at the end of the investigation, inform the American public about what really did and didn't happen. And so I've always been an advocate of that investigation and still am to this day. I want to see the Mueller report released as fully as possible.
So, I mean, and we should say that I think the only leak that ended up getting punished from that had any accountability was Reality Winner, right? I mean, in terms of what we knew about Russian interference into the election.
Yeah, you know, this is something that's actually kind of amazing because obviously I've worked with sources and whistleblowers who have been accused
violating the law, including the Espionage Act, particularly Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. And under the law, the most serious kind of leak where it specifically says that not only the government official who does the leak, but also the newspapers that publish it can actually be found guilty under the Espionage Act. There's only a very small number of categories where you can actually be punished as a journalist for publishing leaks of information. One of those categories is if you leak intercepted communications between a foreign government and someone with whom they're communicating, like the NSA eavesdrops on a call. If you as a newspaper publish those intercepts, under the law, you as a journalist can be punished for that. And yet somebody leaked the communications that Michael Flynn had with the Russian ambassador to the Washington Post, which is a leak I was in favor of because it proved Michael Flynn was lying. But that's like the most serious leak that you can possibly do. And yet there's been no one punished for that leak. Whereas Reality Winner, the leak that she did was something really benign. I mean, she leaked a document that, although it was marked top secret, was clearly something that belonged in the public domain and really didn't jeopardize anyone or anything because she gave it to a news organization, The Intercept, and we redacted information in conjunction with the NSA that they told us would jeopardize people's safety or sources and methods or whatever. So she was incredibly responsible in contrast to, say, David Petraeus, who leaked much more sensitive information, not to inform the public like Reality Winner did, but to get a more positive book from his mistress and didn't go to jail at all. So there's clearly an imbalance there, but you're right. She's the only leaker to have been punished.
Okay. And so, I mean, if there was so much extant that we did not know during this time, when we hear stuff like people saying, and I don't know if you've said it specifically, but that this was a hoax, that this was a scam, is basically what you're talking about a media critique? Because I want to get on to the domestic and foreign implications, but I mean, I'm trying to get like at like what was so problematic, because it seems like is that a fair assessment? Is that when you when we hear things like hoax or scam, it's really just a function of like relatively small group of people in the media, certainly obviously not Fox, was not scamming on this particular topic.
Well, the Fox scammed. I mean, Fox promoted a disgusting conspiracy theory about Seth Rich. But so obviously I do have a critique of the media, CNN and MSNBC in particular, but it extends beyond that. So I think the Democratic Party, politicians like Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell and Chuck Schumer, as well as particularly ex-members of the intelligence community, John Brennan and James Clapper and Michael Hayden, who despised Donald Trump, very much were at the forefront of creating this conspiracy theory, which I don't mean in derogatory sense. I'm just describing neutrally what this is. It's an allegation of a conspiracy that took place that never had any evidence.
That conspiracy theory, I mean, if we're going to define it that way, that was Rod Rosenstein, right? I mean, he tasked Mueller with that, test this conspiracy theory that there was a conspiracy,
absolutely.
Right?
He did the right thing. He said, investigate this, right? Which is much different than going on TV and asserting that it's true.
So my point is that these people did not develop the theory. I mean, look, they may have, I guess. But I mean, as far as I can tell, the edification of the theory of conspiracy was literally the message from Rosenstein to the Mueller investigation. This is the theory.
Sam, that happened in the spring of 2017. And there was at least 8 or 9 months preceding that in which the allegations were constantly being voiced about this conspiracy. The reason that there was an investigation was because people were alleging that this happened.
Well, that's why it became a criminal investigation. The reason why the investigation launched in the first part was because evidence from a foreign envoy who had talked to Papadopoulos, I guess, and that began an intelligence investigation. And coupled with the fact that Trump had brought on an advisor who was already under, suspicion of being some type of Russian asset, Carter Page.
You mean Carter Page,
right? You had an intel investigation at that point, right?
So, well, I mean, it's unclear to this very day what actually started the investigation. There's been news reports that it was the Carter Page suspicions that initiated the investigation. There are reports that, in fact, it was George Papadopoulos. And then there are separate reports that, at least within some sectors of the FBI, what really convinced them was the reporting of the Steele dossier. But let me just, on the question of whether this is a hoax or a scam or anything like that, explain to you what I mean by that. I do not mean by that the existence of an investigation itself was a hoax or a scam, because, as I said, I favored an investigation from the beginning because I really wanted to get to the point that we're now at, where an investigator who pretty much everybody believes or agrees is at least credible, not perfect, but credible, Robert Mueller, had unlimited resources, subpoena power, a massive team of FBI investigators and prosecutors that everyone said were the top-notch, top-level, top-flight investigators, and they spent 22 months digging into every nook and cranny of what happened. And so presumably the Mueller report is going to tell us more or less definitively what happened, which I'm really glad about, that we no longer have to rely on little bits and pieces of anonymous leaks. The reason why I say things are a scam is, let me just give you an anecdote that Michael Isikoff talked about on MSNBC the last time he was on. I don't think he's been on since. Michael Isikoff, to his great credit, because he was one of the earliest reporters who, along with David Korn, injected the Steele dossier into the public discourse, went on the MSNBC and said, not only is it the case that the core allegations of the Steele dossier, he doesn't mean like the PP tape or the Prague meeting, he means like the overall narrative of the Steele dossier, that there was this elaborate, extended, multi-level conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Not only has that been proven to be false because of the lack of evidence for it, but we all had ways to know that it was false. And had we simply been using our rational capacities as opposed to our dug-in kind of invested mentality, we would have on many occasions realized it was false. And the example he gave, which to me is one of the most convincing, although there are a lot of these, is when Robert Mueller indicted Roger Stone for lying to investigators. If you read that indictment, it's really amazing, because what it says is that what Roger Stone lied about to investigators was the nature of the communications he was having with the Trump campaign and the communications he was having with WikiLeaks. And Robert Mueller got the text and the emails between the Trump campaign on the one hand and Roger Stone on the other. And all the way into September or October of 2016, so like not just weeks, but days before WikiLeaks released the Podesta emails, the Trump campaign was saying to Roger Stone, hey, it seems like Julian Assange is saying he has some serious dirt on Hillary Clinton. Can you do anything to find out whether that's true and what he has? And as Michael Isikoff said, the minute Robert Mueller says that, that is the proof that like the Trump campaign was not a participant in this effort, because they had no idea what WikiLeaks had. If they were in bed with the Russians the whole time, they wouldn't have needed Roger Stone to try and desperately get to London and find out from Julian Assange whether or not he had any dirt. And the fact that none of us, or some of very few of us, stopped and said, wait a minute, this indictment shows that this narrative that we've been fed for the last 2 years is false. It negates and refutes the narrative. I think that's what I mean by hoax and scam, that there was no real effort to find the truth. There was this interest in hoping that the Mueller investigation would lead to Trump Jr. and Kushner and Trump being frog marched out of the White House and handcuffed. And that episode kind of encapsulates for me how I think we failed in our discourse.
Now, we should be clear that that Stone was not part of the campaign. So he sort of falls outside of the scope of what at least Barr has said, was being looked at in the context of this conspiracy. and Stone maximizing with WikiLeaks when the best time to release these things would also not be a would not be criminal unless there was some greater, I guess, the way that WikiLeaks got the emails. I mean, we don't know, but I guess to the extent that there would be any type of chain, it's broken between Stone and the campaign, as he's not a member of the campaign, and theoretically WikiLeaks and Russia. So I just want to make that clear to people. So now you are.
But just quickly on that, Sam, if I could just insert one important fact, which is if, like, WikiLeaks has always said, both publicly and then even privately in private chats that got released, Roger Stone is an asshole and a liar. Roger Stone keeps claiming, because this is what Roger Stone has done in his whole career, right? Is he, like, makes himself more important than he really is. So he's going around claiming that he had special knowledge of what WikiLeaks had. The Mueller indictment shows pretty much that Roger Stone was almost entirely in the dark, that he was trying to find out what WikiLeaks had, but knew nothing. And in fact, when he tried to speculate, he got it wrong. He kept saying he thought that this was going to implicate Tony Podesta and that it was about the Clinton Foundation. And that's obviously not what it was about. So even Roger Stone was in the dark. He was trying to find out, like we all were.
We don't know everything that has happened in terms of with Stone, right? I mean, it's still conceivable that there's stuff to happen. So I don't know if that chapter is really written yet, but up to this point, yes, that's correct. Now, I noticed, like, when you talk about the Mueller investigation, you're not saying there's no evidence, that he found no evidence anymore. Because all we know from the Barr assessment is that to the extent that he found any evidence, and maybe he didn't find any, but he could have also found some, right? But just not enough for an indictment. You agree with that?
So we're not going to know until the Mueller report is released what exactly Robert Mueller said, right? But I do think it's important to note the following. In general, prosecutors have a very narrow mandate, right? They're supposed to answer one very technical, narrow, cramped question, which is not, is somebody guilty of wrongdoing or not, but is there enough evidence to justify an indictment with some degree of certainty that you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a courtroom that they're guilty of that crime. And oftentimes prosecutors decline to indict somebody, even though they believe they're guilty, because it doesn't rise to that really high level that we've set as a society for criminally convicting somebody, right? Beyond reasonable doubt. And in general, that's all prosecutors are supposed to do. They're supposed to just say, I'm indicting or I'm not. And when they don't indict, they're not supposed to accuse anybody of wrongdoing because it's really unfair, right? Like, imagine if a prosecutor says, I investigated Sam Cedar for pedophilia. I decided not to indict him, which means you have no chance to defend yourself. But there was a lot of evidence that Sam Cedar is actually a pedophile. It just didn't rise to that would be the most unfair thing to you possible, because then you're accused, but you have no chance to defend yourself. That's why people were so upset with what Jim Comey did to Hillary Clinton, right? He held a press conference and he said, I'm not going to indict her, but she did all kinds of terrible things. And it was like,
The problem with what Comey did was that you're not supposed to do that within a certain distance of an election. I mean, that is one of the sort of the key principles of public corruption cases. There were other issues with that, but yes.
He was unfair to Hillary Clinton because he accused Hillary Clinton of wrongdoing, even though he didn't indict her, which is something prosecutors never do. And Comey's defense is like, look, in this case, it was such an exceptional case that had I simply said I'm not indicting Hillary Clinton with no explanation, 50% of the country would have concluded that the Justice Department was corrupted for partisan reasons. So that's usually what prosecutors do. Mueller, as I understand it, and as the Rod Rosenstein letter says, and as the special counsel statute describes, has a much broader mandate than that. He's not simply acting as a prosecutor deciding whether or not the evidence rises to the level where indictments are warranted. We already know he indicted nobody for conspiring with the Russians over the election. We already know that he didn't indict Trump Jr. with the Russian government. Right. We already know that he didn't indict
Well, he didn't indict any Americans for conspiring with Russians over the election.
Well, but that wasn't his mandate, right? I mean, the what we know from the Barr letter is that very specific, like you say, there was a very, very narrow mandate, as at least as that no members of the Trump campaign, right, conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. So theoretically, they could have conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in other activities, and non-members of the Trump campaign could have done that. And Russian, I don't know, friends of Russian government theoretically could do that. In terms of like what that line says, we don't know anymore without seeing the Mueller report, is my point.
Okay, that's fair enough. Although I think in order to know the mandate of the Mueller investigation, the key document to look at is not the Barr letter, but the Rod Rosenstein letter appointing Robert Mueller and describing what his investigation was supposed to examine. And there it was pretty broad. It was not just did the Trump campaign conspire. It was also links between the Trump campaign on the one hand and the Russian government on the other.
Individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. I mean, and we don't know yet, though, right? I mean, that's the thing. We don't know how – we just know what Barr has presented to us.
But we do know – but we do know some things. So – like I said, we know that Rogers, that the Trump campaign as late as September, October of 2016 didn't know what WikiLeaks had, which is why they were trying to get Roger Stone to find out. We know that Mueller closed his investigation without indicting any Trump campaign officials or members of the Trump family for doing any of what you just read, having links to the Russian government or conspiring or collaborating with them over the election, right? There are no indictments. And the point that I was making just now is that Mueller's mandate is not this narrowed standard prosecutorial mandate of tell us whether there's enough evidence to justify an indictment. The Mueller mandate as a special counsel is write a report telling us what actually happened. So this segment of the Barr report that he quoted, which, you know, I don't think anybody thinks that Barr just fabricated a quote. Even these anonymous objectors who are saying that Barr's letter left incriminating stuff out have made clear that they're talking about the obstruction section of the Barr letter and not the collusion or conspiracy section. But we need to know what that sentence is. But when Mueller says the evidence doesn't establish that there was collaboration or conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia, I don't think he's simply saying I didn't find enough evidence to rise to that really high level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think he's saying, I'm speaking as somebody here to tell you what my investigation found happened. We already know he didn't indict. He's saying, this report is designed to tell you what happened, and the evidence doesn't establish that this happened. Now, we should wait for the Mueller report to say for sure, but that to me is my understanding of what Robert Mueller was doing in that report.
Okay, so you're saying that there's the standard of where I'm going to bring an indictment, then there's the standard of what I believe, and then below that may be some evidence, but this is the level of establish. Here's indictment, here's establish, here's anything down to completely exonerated, I guess.
Precise. I mean, nobody would say no evidence, right? Like the Trump Tower meeting is evidence, right? So then the question is it like compelling evidence? Is it convincing? So yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
I feel like there were people who were getting out in front of their skis on this stuff. And you may be right about what establish means in that instance. We're not going to know until we see the report. And I hope we do end up seeing that. All right. So let me ask you this about the stakes. This is the thing that I also don't understand. And I agree with the critique. I feel that people went overboard with this. I'm not surprised. Certain politicians leveraged it. And, you know, to the extent that we didn't necessarily spend a lot of time critiquing it. But basically what we just did is did other stuff that we thought was more important. I mean, implicit in my editorial decisions every day is a function of what we think people should be paying attention to. But what are the stakes from your perspective? Because, you know, one of the things, I mean, you cited Matt Taibbi's piece about it being like weapons of mass destruction. And I get the I think it's a bad analogy. And I get the idea that this was a that people perceive it as a big hoax, or that they were carrying water, that it was a conspiracy theory. But it seems to me the import of a hoax and whatnot is the stakes that's involved here. And because I don't see really, I mean, there's marginal implications to this investigation, to Adam Schiff, you know, hyping it, and to maybe Rachel Maddow dedicating too much of her show to it. But I don't really see what the massive stakes are that seem to be there.
Okay. So I'll give you my view of that. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has this doomsday clock that is measuring how close humanity is to apocalyptic catastrophe, basically the destruction of the planet, and has had this clock since the end of World War II. And that clock is currently at 2 minutes before midnight, midnight being the destruction of the Earth and humanity as a species, which is the most acute rating it's given to humanity since 1953, when the US and the Soviet Union came very, very close to nuclear annihilation. And in its report explaining why it's at 2 minutes before midnight, it lists two principal reasons, one of which is apocalyptic climate scenarios, the other of which is the threat of nuclear war between the United States and Russia. So the U.S. and Russia, even though the Soviet Union fell and the Cold War sort of is over, although I think it's been revitalized over the last 3 years, continue to have thousands of intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear tips pointed at one another's cities. And so when you create this kind of narrative that Russia is our enemy, something that President Obama, to his great credit, and I credited him contemporaneously, was desperate to avoid. He was desperate to avoid provoking the Kremlin, putting the U.S. in a position where it was geopolitically adverse to the Kremlin. When you create this narrative that the Russians are our enemy, that speaking to Russia is evidence of some sort of sinister motives, I think that's an extremely dangerous and reckless thing to do. And then the other part of it is, I think that there has been this revitalization on the part of a huge number of people who are paying attention to politics for the first time because of fear of Trump, of putting faith in these institutions that the left had finally successfully convinced people in the wake of the Iraq War to start distrusting, like the CIA, like the FBI, like the NSA, like the military. I think there's been this very kind of jingoistic, pro-military, pro-security state ethos, neocons being integrated into MSNBC, into the liberal kind of fabric, that I also think is independently damaging from a domestic political perspective.
Okay, first off, in terms of like the atomic clock thing, from 2018, the first three paragraphs of the "it's now 2 minutes to midnight" assessment talk about North Korea. That's from 2018. In 2017, it mentions the United States and Russia, but then climate change comes in, and they also include in that first paragraph Pakistan and India. And in 2016, I mean, I think it's, I mean, there is, in 2016, it is the same, and 2015, it's the same in terms of like there's no change. 2016 was more climate change, of course, but the amount of change that we're talking about in that 30 seconds is a function of North Korea, and so, which of course has nothing to do with this. And I agree with your, I mean, so that that to me seems, I think, a dubious impact from this. I'm looking at polling from where the American public looks at Russia. And there's no doubt that there's been, you know, it's more in the popular culture. Maybe Saturday Night Live is talking about it. But the polling shows no difference between 2015 and 2017 or 2019 between your overall opinion of Russia. 70% were unfavorable in February of 2015, and 73% in February of 2019, and that's within the margin of error, that change. Same with, like, in terms of whether they're a danger. Like, the atomic clock thing, I think, is really, I think it's a non-starter. I mean, maybe there could be some element.
Let me just address a couple of things.
Let me address the other one.
Right.
The other one about the institutions. MSNBC was tacking to the right before Donald Trump won in anticipation of Hillary Clinton winning. This is public knowledge. They've almost every contributor that they've hired over the past couple of years has either been at this point a prosecutor, former prosecutor, and I agree,
right. Right.
And or a Republican. And I think it's a shame. Believe me, I think it's a shame. But MSNBC is not a, you know, an important pillar of our society. So I think there are legitimate critiques, but I think they're overblown, frankly. I mean, I just don't see the fallout from this. And it's not like Russia didn't do what, you know, and you and I agree. I think that it was probably not as significant as people make it out to be. But that part of it is not even a function of whether Donald Trump colluded with it or not.
Right. I do think that the kind of disproportionate treatment of this kind of like Russia interfered in our sacred democracy rhetoric is misleading and dangerous, because not only have these two countries done it to other countries far worse forever, but even to one another, right? Like the U.S. boasted of helping Boris Yeltsin.
Even better, let's say that that's very problematic and let's us not do it. You know, like
right,
I'm
right,
willing to leverage that as that's a bad thing to do. So therefore, we should not be involved in any way in what's going on in Venezuela.
Right. Let's look at this, because this issue about the state of U.S.-Russian relations, and I've reported a lot on the Bulletin of Atomic Science report. I don't have it in front of me. I think that we have some differences about the extent to which they're emphasizing the dangers of nuclear war between those two countries. Obviously, in 2018, when Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were threatening to annihilate one another on Twitter, that became something that got the attention of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. But throughout that report, there's a constant reference to the U.S. and Russia, because under the Trump administration, contrary to the prevailing wisdom, there has been a far greater proliferation of belligerence and confrontation with Russia in really dangerous ways. So you look, for example, I think one of the most disturbing examples is the question of sending lethal arms to Ukraine, probably the most important country geopolitically to Russia. In 2015, 2016, you can Google this, Democrats and Republicans were demanding that Obama send lethal arms to Ukrainians to fight against the Russians. And he said, are you out of your mind? Why would we risk provocation with Russia over a country that's of immediate interest to them, but not to us? So Obama refused. The Trump administration sent lethal arms to the Ukrainians. The Trump administration is currently in the process of trying to destabilize and remove from power a really important leader of a very important geopolitical country, or an oil-rich country, that is a longtime ally of the Kremlin, which is the Maduro regime, while the Russian military is on the ground trying to defend the Maduro government from being removed. On top of which, you have Donald Trump going to Germany and badgering Angela Merkel, successfully to some extent now, to stop buying natural gas from Russia and instead buy it from U.S. companies, on the not unreasonable ground that the U.S. spends huge amounts of money through NATO to defend Germany. So why should Germany be buying natural gas from Russia instead of buying it from the U.S.? An incredibly threatening thing to do to the Kremlin, because if Europe stopped buying natural gas from Russia, it would probably tank the entire Russian economy. So you see the U.S. and Russia, there's a huge naval buildup in the Black Sea. The Americans confronted Russia for the first time in the Japan Sea since 1987. There's a possible military base being constructed in Poland. In all these hotspots around the world, you see Russian-U.S. tensions increasing. At the same time, the climate in Washington is such that you can't even talk to Russians, which is why a lot of these Trump officials lied about their connections with Russia, because every time you talk to a Russian official, it gets depicted as some kind of treasonous conspiracy or collusion. And that's what I think is so dangerous, is you have this increasing belligerence and escalation between the U.S. and the Russians on the one hand, and hot spots around the world, Syria being another that I didn't even mention. Trump bombed, you know, Assad very limited in a very limited way, but Obama refused to because he was scared of the escalation problems that that would bring. And at the same time, an inability to talk to the Russians, which miscommunication, miscalculation in the past is what led to inadvertent nuclear exchanges. So I do think minimizing the danger of that is ill-advised. And then just quickly on how we see...
But wait, let me just address those, because every single one of those policies that you've talked about were longstanding Republican policies. I mean, every single one. And whether it was Chavez or Maduro, buying gas from the U.S. is a function of, all you need to do is look at some of Donald Trump's biggest supporters, the same ones who put every head of EPA in there. They all want this. They wanted this from day one. They basically built a there's a reason why he built his first version, Trump cabinet V1 was basically just full of oil executives and generals. And so the idea of, all of these things are completely consistent with long-term Republican agendas, and totally. to the point where Manafort, was so insistent on changing the Republican platform. That's why all the lights went off, started flashing, because it was specifically about that provision about not selling lethal weapons to Crimea. I mean, that's why it was such a big deal, that it was such a divergence from standard issue Republican policy
Sam, Donald Trump himself is a huge divergence from standard Republican ideology. He ran against the Iraq War, even though...
Well, I know what he did in the election, what has he done that has been divergent from Republican orthodoxy since he's been in office? I mean, calling for cuts in Medicare. He just had massive tax cuts.
Domestically, he's a full. I agree. I mean, this is one of the things that I think is true about the Trump presidency, and I actually said this last week, is that you have kind of his freakish circus tweeting that obviously is wildly out of the range of normalcy for how presidents speak and conduct themselves, and the stuff he says is campaign rallies. And then you have over here kind of the actual governance. And the governance itself is, I think, well within the range of standard Republican orthodoxy. I agree with that entirely. I was simply saying that Republican orthodoxy, and by the way, Democratic orthodoxy, remember Obama's refusal to act against Russia and Ukraine, to bomb Assad, was wildly criticized by the whole bipartisan foreign policy class in Washington. They thought Obama was appeasing Putin constantly. So I agree. I think I agree totally with you that the Trump administration has been belligerent toward Russia in a way that Republican orthodoxy has long called for, which is why I have been so contemptuous of the idea that Donald Trump is this Russian asset sitting in the White House, forcing the United States to act in Russian interest, when in fact Russian American policy over and over and over and over again has been directly contrary to and threatening to vital Russian interests, not ancillary Russian interests, but vital Russian interests.
I think there's an argument that the sanctions relief, which he certainly pursued, which is basically just putting money in people's pockets at the end of the day, that is a pretty big incentive. For him following all the Republican orthodoxy and this national security establishment orthodoxy, you do have things like, we're going to burn the translator records, or we're not going to take any records of this meeting between these two heads of these two states. I mean, that's the only unorthodox thing he's doing. And that's a very, I can understand why people would be like, wow, that's a very strange thing to do. And what's behind that? I mean, that's fairly intriguing, right? I mean, we're going to have record of it.
You can look at it, right? You can look at it that way, or you can look. You know what the Trump people say is, every time Trump talks to the Russians, it ends up leaking, because people in the CIA or people in the FBI who wanted to pick Trump as a Russian stooge, which is going on since the campaign, end up leaking what he says to Putin. And you can't have frank relations between leaders if both of them think that what they end up saying to one another is going to end up being leaked. And so taking precautions to make sure that those conversations aren't leaked doesn't seem like an entirely sinister thing, to me at least, to do. I mean, that seems like a fairly rational thing. But let me just address this, the second part about public perceptions of both Russia and the FBI. I think that if you look at overall polling, you're right that if you compare 2015 polling about how Russia is perceived or the FBI is perceived to 2019 polling about how Russia or the FBI is perceived, or for that matter, WikiLeaks, it kind of stays the same. So the number of Americans who view Russia favorably in 2015 is the same as the number of Americans who view them the same in 2019, view them favorably in 2019. But what has changed radically is the partisan breakdown. So in 2014, Republicans adored and revered the CIA and the FBI, and the Democrats were skeptical. That has now almost completely reversed. There's a huge upsurge in trust and faith that Democrats place in those institutions, and a complete collapse in the trust and faith that Republicans have been put in them, because Republicans have been fed the narrative that this is a corrupt deep state trying to overthrow the democratically elected government, whereas Democrats have been fed the opposite narrative that these are the agencies that are going to save us from the criminality of Trump. Same with Russia. 2013, 2014, Marco Rubio, John McCain, all of those guys were saying Putin is this evil regime, Obama is appeasing them. So the Republicans were being told that Russia is this grave threat that Obama was insufficiently standing up to. That is completely reversed. 2012 said it's the number one geopolitical threat. Obama mocked him for it, said the Cold War wants the 1980s wants its foreign policy back. So all of it's kind of been fundamentally reversed, right? In the way that often happens when the parties change the White House. So you're right that overall the perception is the same, but I don't think there's any question. I think the polling data you're referring to demonstrates, I know it does on the question of the FBI, I'm almost certain it does on the question of Russia, that Democrats see Russia as a greater threat than they did 3 or 4 years ago, which would make sense. That Democrats trust the FBI and CIA more than they did 3 or 4 years ago. And that's what I'm really worried about, is that, you know, for a long time in this country, we did have a Democratic Party that were the Cold Warriors, right? Harry Truman is the one who dropped 2 nuclear bombs on Japan. It was John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson who prosecuted the Vietnam War, the sort of Iraq War of that generation. And I'm really worried that the Democratic Party is embracing, and it's why the neocons are now migrating back to the Democratic Party, this kind of militaristic, imperialistic, jingoistic ethos that I think is really harmful and that I've always been opposed to from the time that I began writing about politics. That's the worry that I have. Not that overall the body politic is embracing these narratives that Russia is a threat and the FBI and CIA are good and trustworthy, but that Democrats in particular are, because not just MSNBC, and I mean, Rachel Maddow is really influential, but it's not just her at all. It's CNN also has a huge number of former prosecutors, former military officials that they also hired to help shape the news. Those are the sources that the New York Times and the Washington Post quote. I just think that there's been too much of a rehabilitation of neocons and the truth of these agencies, and that's what I worry about.
I couldn't agree with you more about that. And I think, you know, I think that's true. And I think to a certain extent, some of that is inevitable. I mean, as a, you know, a joke that, fortunately I don't think it's been him as much, although to some extent, but one of the biggest problems we were talking about in the summer of 2016 was, if Donald Trump wins, then we all have to pretend like Jonathan Chait knows what he's talking about again. And I agree. This is all, but to a certain extent, this is all sort of predictable and cyclical, in a function of who's in office and who's not out. I mean, that's why, yeah. Like, it seems to me all of the critiques you're making were just as valid regardless of what the Mueller investigation found. I mean, it wasn't hinged on, in my mind, as to what we find in that report. All of those things are true regardless, as far as I'm concerned. But
I don't know that we've left anything on the table. Do you?
No, I guess the only thing I would add is that, did you have something that you... I did.
Yeah,
go ahead. I had one thing that I wanted to buy, but you go ahead first.
Do you think I needed to apologize to have Marcy Wheeler on the program?
No, I do not. Look, Michael, let me just say this about those of us who have been expressing skepticism about the overriding narrative that the non-Fox media has more or less unanimously embraced. And there were people inside of these news outlets, I heard from them all the time, who also had a lot of skepticism about what was being reported and what was being said and kind of felt like they weren't able to express them because they saw what happened to those of us who were doing that. We were banished from a lot of media platforms that previously we had regular access to. I think the last time Matt Taibbi was on MSNBC was like December of 2016 or January of 2017. I don't think Jeremy Scahill has been on in 3 years. I haven't been on since December 2016 when I talked to Ari Melber about the need for skepticism. But on top of that, I think that a lot of us who are expressing the skepticism were vilified not just for being wrong, which is fair enough. That's what happens in political debates, but for being Trump apologists or even Trump supporters or even paid agents of the Kremlin. I don't mean by random trolls on Twitter. I mean by like really prominent people. So I can understand why after 3 years, nerves are kind of raw. Matt Taibbi and Michael Tracy talked about the psychological toll this has taken on them, which, you know, you can kind of dismiss and mock. But at the same time, you know, it is real when you're trying to kind of push some dissent into you feel like you're standing in front of a freight train. And when you feel like at least some of what you've been doing has not been fully vindicated, but at least somewhat been affirmed, like at least the need for skepticism all along, I think there's a recognition that at least Rachel Maddow and people like that went too far. I understand why people are being a little overly zealous. And I also think the issue that about what Marcy did with turning in her own source to the FBI, in the face of a subpoena, but proactively and voluntarily, and then got celebrated for it by the media, is something that we ought to revisit at some point. I don't want to talk about Marcy when she's not here, I think Marcy is an extremely intelligent, diligent reporter. She's one of the first people I tried to hire when we started The Intercept, who we did hire. If I had a show, I would put Marcy on. So no, I don't think putting Marcy on is something that you ought to apologize for. But I do think we should revisit that issue about that turning in of the source on the ground.
I have a feeling there'll be ample opportunity in the future. I don't know if maybe we'll see the investigation when we see the report. We'll have a sense of what the implications of that are, and I imagine that's a story. And that's certainly, I mean, from my perspective, when I came in on that Monday after the report had been dropped, I was like, I guess we're going to have to talk about this today and push our, you know, I don't want to counter program with somebody who's talking about the implications of slavery and politics, you know, antebellum Civil War. But having Marcy on, it seemed to me, would be more apt when we have a sense of what the full report says. But I appreciate that, and I do appreciate that there has been an excess on the side of people who, you know, really wanted to believe that Donald Trump would be removed from office over this, and maybe other things. I don't think so, but I don't think it's going to be possible to get him out of that office in that way. But yes, I think that there's been excesses on both sides of this argument that I think have been, you know, inappropriate, frankly. But Glenn, I appreciate your coming on and talking about it. And I guess we now wait to see what's actually in the report.
Yes, exactly.
All right,
Sam. Great.
Thanks,
thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Glenn, can we all come together as one? I can't elaborate from like what the office version of that joke, that bit is, but keen observers could fill in the blanks. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Sam is en route to Vegas. Thursday, I'll be in the main chair. I think we're going to do a Newsday, go over the Israeli elections, some things that are happening today. We'll go over them a bit as well in the fun half. I thought that was actually pretty solid. I don't necessarily know how much more there is to say about it.
I feel like that horse has been beaten a little bit.
I think so. I hate that phrase, but I think you're right.
I love that phrase because I'm from the Dakotas.
Because you're from the Dakotas.
It's literal for Matt.
It's like, you know, beat that son bitch. I don't know why I give you that voice, but it's funny. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Leave us a rating on iTunes. Subscribe on YouTube. Spread the word. All of those things. And, of course, you can follow us on social media. On tonight's Michael Brooks show, Felix Biederman's in studio. We're going to do a real deep dive into the longer history of the Meghan McCain Joy Behar drama. We're also talking about Dave Rubin. Some new insight. I really think I'm on something here. QAnon and the Gambino family, a bunch more stuff. Soumya Shankar on India's elections and a kind of history around the BJP and Hindutva. Become a patron, patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole Michael Brooks Show experience. And also, Matt, can we throw up on screen? We have, I don't know exactly how many tickets left to the LA Live Show at the Bootleg Theater. On April 20th with special guests Nando Vila, Big Waz, Wozni Lambre, and Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks. I know the Young Turks, I think, are going to start doing a promotion on it, and we're already well over halfway sold out. So these will go and have been going quick. So I would get your tickets now. You can get your VIP tickets or your regular admittance tickets, and we will see you in LA April 20th, of course, Matt and David Griscom along with me. Jamie, what's up?
So this past weekend, the guys from Street Fight, Brett Payne and Murder Brian, were in town for the epic live show they did at Littlefield. So we took the opportunity to record with them because we are in many ways kindred spirits. They are the number one anarcho-comedy radio show in the country. So we had them on to talk about workers' inquiry, kratom, parenting, drugs, and small business tyrants. And I'm really excited. It's out now for patrons and tomorrow for everyone. So check it out.
Sweet. Matt?
Yeah, Literary Hangover, the Oscar Wilde episode is up on the podcast feed. And the King Philip's War episode is up on the YouTube. Subscribe to the YouTube. I'll have the Oscar Wilde episode up hopefully today, unless I made a typo in the exporting of the video, which sometimes happens and takes another 14 hours to pump one out. So we'll see.
And of course, I should say 7 p.m. tonight on Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. We'll see you in the fun half.
You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled.
Oh, you left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's
the ultimate math nerd, don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy!
Dance, dance, dance!
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.